Okay, today's a kind of unusual class. It's what I'm going to try and do is talk a little bit about what's to be taken away from a course like this. Right? At a certain level, you're going to be taking away a certain understanding of specific historical problems. You've learned a lot of facts. You've learned what the Schlieffen plan was. You've gotten some insight into this question of the origins of the First World War, and all these issues that we've been talking about in the course of the quarter. What was Bismarck's policy? How did the Vienna system work? Meaning of the Congress of Vienna. You know, all those things are very important. I don't want to deny that. And a certain factual command is absolutely essential. But for the purposes of this course, those things are not the fundamental goal. They're important, but we're interested in something more basic than that. What are we interested in? We're interested in something conceptual at a higher level of abstraction. We're interested in getting some insight into these fundamental questions that define the whole field of international relations. Right? These questions about how a world of sovereign powers, how a world of independent states works. How does a system defined by the absence of overarching authority work? We're interested in specifically in the question of, does that system push states into conflict with each other? In other words, getting some insight into the great issue of war and peace. What makes for war? Or conversely, what makes for a stable international system? And related to that, these issues about policy, about foreign policy. What makes for good foreign policy? Is there anything of a general nature? Are there any general principles you could put your finger on that should guide foreign policy in some sense? Those are the fundamental issues. And when you're thinking about what the point of this course was, whether you've gotten anything out of this course, what you want to take away from a course like this, you should think in terms of how your own understanding of those issues has changed in the course of the quarter. Whether you've gotten any insight into those questions that you didn't have when you set foot in this classroom almost 10 weeks ago. That's the test. You should ask yourselves those questions. Right? And what I could do here is talk a little bit about myself and how my own thinking has changed as a result of, you know, basically spending a lifetime studying these issues. Ever since I was an undergraduate at Berkeley in 1962, when I first became interested in this stuff. At that point, I had absorbed certain general notions from the larger culture about how war is to be understood. To be understood as the product of aggression. There are peace-loving countries, there are aggressor states. You want to figure out what causes a war, you have to figure out who the aggressor is. Aggressor basically presses a button, throws a switch, starts a war. Right? And so the whole goal was to figure out who is to blame, who the guilty party was. War is the product of aggression. Now, this notion is very deeply embedded, especially in American culture, but well beyond the United States. During the Cold War, we had this strategy of deterrence. The whole notion of the strategy of deterrence presumed that wars were started by aggressors. aggressor is considering whether to start a war. The aggressor considers what the results of that decision would be. If the aggressor is convinced that starting a war would be unprofitable, the aggressor will decide not to start a war, so you would have peace. If deterrence fails, you have war. Everything is focused on the calculations of an aggressor during a crisis. You know, moment of truth. And what I came to see is that whole approach to the problem of war and peace, with all of its implications about the kinds of policies that should be adopted, you know, is deeply, deeply inadequate. Why is it inadequate? Well, this whole notion that you can make these moral judgments fairly easily. You could because saying one power is the aggressor and the other is the victim is essentially a moral judgment. The whole notion of aggression is very morally loaded. Those judgments are highly problematic. You know, this again is a theme in the course. You know, World War I. You just look at the immediate conflict between Austria and Serbia. You know, who's to say that the Austrians didn't have a right to insist on certain limitations on Serbian sovereignty and independence, given that the Serbs had this policy directed at the dismantling of the Austrian state? The Serbs would say it was a policy directed at the liberation of the southern Slavs within Austria-Hungary. Who's to say that the Serbs were wrong? You believe in the principle of self-determination? Shouldn't you sympathize with the Serbs? Right? Yet, who's to say these things? Where do these judgments come from? Well, everyone is free to kind of make their own judgments, right? The yardstick lies outside the kind of scholarly analysis. You know, you're not going to answer that question of what the right yardstick will be simply by studying the documents in greater and greater depth. You are applying moral standards to the study of the evidence. So focusing on these moral judgments is not a way of getting at the issues that we're really interested in, which is the issue of how do you explain this conflict? So put the moral issues aside and try and understand the dynamics of the story. Try and understand the logic underlying the course of events. You know, how one thing led to another. And the role that power considerations played in that logic. And what that does is it leads you to a totally different view of what policy should be. Instead of focusing policy on crises and on the aggressor's moment of truth, what you have to do is think of policy. The goal of policy is to affect the way a political process that could lead to war or could lead to a more stable international system, affect the way that political process runs its course over a period of years, over a period of decades. And when you're making judgments, as you ultimately have to do, drawing conclusions about what policy should be, or should have been in particular points in the past, when you're making those judgments about policy, you can't simply focus on times of crisis. You're judging policies as a whole. Policies of states that were in play for years, for decades, right? Do those policies help the political process move into relatively peaceful channels, or do they lead to conflicts? Do they lead to instability? All right. Okay. Another way of looking at this issue is to say that you got to strike a balance between structure and statecraft. To a certain extent, That logic that underlies the course of events is a structural logic. It has to do with the way a system based on power works. But you can't simply reduce everything to structure, because although the policy-making process is constrained by power political considerations, there's always a certain play. There's always a certain degree of freedom for political leaders to make choices, to opt for one policy as opposed to another. And so the question is, how narrow or how broad is that range of choice? In other words, how powerful are these structural forces? You know, how do you strike the balance between structure and statecraft? And you got to do that, because when you're looking at policies with the idea of what are we to make of them, what sort of conclusions are we to draw about these particular policies, you have to take into account the fact that statesmen are never totally free agents, that their choices are always constrained by the structure of the system within which they find themselves. Okay. So that's what we were trying to do. What was the dynamic here? What's the logic underlying the course of events in the period that we've been interested in? And the whole latter part of the course, we began really with the unification of Germany in 1871, and the logic of the system created by the way that war ended, right? Two great events: the transformation of the European political system, from Central Europe being a kind of power vacuum, where the rivalry between Austria and Prussia basically, you know, resulted in Germany not being a powerful central unit there. A system which was basically dominated by the wing powers, you know, Russia in the east and Britain and France in the west. And now a system where the most powerful state in Europe was the new German Empire, right? But a German Empire that had, by annexing Alsace-Lorraine, you know, precluded normal relations with France. Germany and France can never be. Bismarck is not interested in further territorial change. He's not reaching for total hegemony in Europe. Germany said over and over again, satiated power. Even so, this did not mean that he could be oblivious to what was going on in terms of political relations among the other European powers. Germany's not strong enough to not have to worry about political complications in the rest of Europe, right? Not a hegemon. And so the whole goal for Bismarck to provide for German security is to make sure that Germany was one of three. You know, in a Europe of five great powers, the key thing is to be one of three, bloc of three, right? And given that Germany's relations with France precluded France being part of a bloc of three with Germany, that meant effectively that there are only two solutions. One, the bloc of the three Eastern empires, Germany, Russia, Austria, or alternatively, an alignment between Germany, Austria, and Britain. Right? Why did this logic set in? It was because Bismarck had essentially opted for Austria, for the maintenance of Austria as a great power. To maintain Austria as a great power, you had to basically maintain, not totally the status quo in Southeastern Europe, maintain a situation where Russian power was excluded from Southeastern Europe. Because even if the Russians came down and dominated just the eastern part of the Balkans, this is, say, Romania, Bulgaria, the area down to the Turkish Straits, the mere fact that Russian power would be present in the eastern part of the Balkans would almost automatically create problems for Austria in the western part of the Balkans. Russia's a stronger country than Austria. You know, if you wanted to keep Russian power limited, you had to essentially keep the Russians out of the Balkans in their entirety, which was the meaning of Bismarck's alliance with Romania. Romania would be an iron barrier across the path of expansion of Russia down into the Balkans. Right? So you're opting for Austria. Okay. What this meant was there is this possibility of a bloc of three powers, Britain, Germany, and Austria, based on the containment of Russian expansionists. So you have these three possible alignments, but neither of them was perfect. In the one case, the bloc of the three Eastern empires, you had this fundamental problem of Austria and Russia being divided over the Balkans. And given that Austria was weaker than Russia, Germany's position was constantly being tested. You know, because, you know, the only thing ultimately that would keep Russia from moving was if Germany sided with Austria there. Okay? So it was a precarious alignment from Bismarck's point of view. Why should Russia go along with this arrangement once it became clear what Germany was really up to? These honeyed words, these assurances and so on, you know, they would wear thin. And so then you had the opposite sort of alignment, the alignment with Britain, directed at the containment of Russian expansionism. In a sense, this is a more natural alignment because it rested on a clear geopolitical foundation. But here you had this problem of the British government changing its party basis every 7 years or so. And when liberals like Gladstone came in, they were unwilling to cooperate with this because they were sympathetic with the rights of the Balkan nationalities. Right? And what this would be to kind of expose Germany and Austria to Russian antagonism, Russian power, risk driving Russia over to the side of France. Plus, there's this basic geographical asymmetry between Germany and Britain. Britain is an island, relatively secure, you know, with its vast sea power, its lead industrialization. Germany is right there in the middle of the continent of Europe. Germany is much more exposed to the risk of European complications. And that asymmetry gave Britain a little too much in the way of freedom of action for Bismarck's taste. Right? Certainly he didn't want to put all of his eggs in that basket. And so what you had is this policy during the Bismarckian period, a kind of optimal policy when you think about it, given the fact that the Germans were determined to hang on to Alsace-Lorraine, a balancing between these two possible alignments, not precluding one or the other. Right? Keeping the line open to St. Petersburg, but also trying to draw the British in. Because if Britain joined forces with Austria in support of a policy of keeping Russian power at bay in the Balkans, then Germany could pursue a relatively passive line and not have to worry too much about how the Russians would react to the situation. Right? So that's the situation as it existed, especially in the climax of the Bismarckian period. The agreements of the year 1887, the reinsurance treaty with Russia, it's the line to St. Petersburg. The Mediterranean agreements with the British, drawing in of the British into this bloc. You're trying to do both of these things because neither of them is rock solid. And in fact, the whole set of alignments during the Bismarckian period is not rock solid. It's not surprising that it would unravel, which it did, in large part because of the choices made by Bismarck's successors after Bismarck was dismissed in 1890. You have the new emperor, William II, coming in and trying first to, you know, pursue a policy based on the alignment with England, refusing to renew the reinsurance treaty. And then when the British really wouldn't come through in the way that he had hoped, He realizes the error of his ways, then goes, you know, back to St. Petersburg as a kind of supplicant, trying to mend fences with the Russians. But by this point, the Russians realize how strong they are and how they're in talk with France in 1891, followed by the alliance of 1893-94 with France. You know, how that had strengthened the Russian position. It wasn't that Russia had moved to France out of his fear of Germany. The Russian alignment with France was a source of strength for Russia. And the new alignment, the brunt of the new alignment, was borne not by Germany, but by Britain. You know, because the French and Russian fleets together could give the British fleet a good run for the money. Right? So the whole drama of the 1890s, the period from 1894 on especially, is this whole question of which way will the British go? The answer to that question is going to determine the fundamental structure of the system. Which way will the British go? And the British have these three choices. One choice is to align themselves with Germany and Austria. Second choice is to try and mend fences with France and Russia. And the third choice is to the policy of the free hand. Trust to the fact that the two continental blocs are evenly divided, that there's no way they'll come together in a continental bloc against Britain, given the Franco-German dispute over Alsace-Lorraine and the Austro-Russian dispute over the Balkans. And you could maintain a free hand. That was Salisbury's position. But increasingly, as Britain's relative power declined, as Germany's relative power grew because of these economic changes that we saw taking place in the course of the century, the policy of the free hand became increasingly untenable. People felt Britain couldn't afford to go that route. Britain wasn't strong enough to have a totally free hand. See how power considerations come into play here. And so finally, you have Britain ending the policy of so-called isolation. Never really was isolation. First with the alliance with Japan, and then following the outbreak of the Russo-Japanese War, with the Entente with France. In other words, Japan's ally Britain makes an entente with Russia's ally France, even though Russia and Japan are at war at that time. Quite remarkable. And the Anglo-French entente leads first to the first Moroccan crisis, ultimately to the Triple Entente, when we have the Anglo-Russian Agreement of 1907. The important thing about that period is the emergence of the antagonism between Britain and Germany as the central conflict in international politics. You can look at the First World War as the coming together of these three great conflicts. The conflict between France and Germany over Alsace-Lorraine, the conflict between Austria and Russia over the Balkans, and the conflict now between Britain and Germany over these imperial, naval, colonial issues. And the more we understand about what was going on, the clearer it is that Germany's ambition, long-term goal, was to displace Britain as the world's dominant imperial power, the world's premier imperial power. Right? That's the point of the German fleet. Okay. The Anglo-German antagonism moves to center stage. Each of those countries now views the other as its principal adversary, in fact, principal enemy in the world. And in that situation, the British move toward a clearer and clearer anti-German policy. You see it, first of all, during the first Moroccan crisis in 1905, and then during the second Moroccan crisis in 1911. The British at times seem more intent on having a tough line than even the French. The hole gets dug deeper and deeper between Germany and the Western powers. That's the meaning of the two Moroccan crises. And yet the importance of this whole phenomenon is not simply that particular relationship is being poisoned, but rather what effect it has on the system as a whole. In particular, what effect it has on Russia's position in this power political system. Because as relations between Germany and the Western powers get worse, Russia's position automatically improves. Right? The Germans hope to break the Entente. To do that, they hope to wean Russia away from the Western powers. They play up to Russia. But the more Germany plays up to Russia, the more the Western powers feel that they have to outbid Germany for Russian favor. There's this competition for Russian favor. And one of the most striking things about this whole period is that despite Russia's astonishing defeat at the hands of Japan in 1905, and all of the domestic political consequences of that, the demonstration of how weak the Russian absolutist regime was, right? In spite of that, because of these diplomatic changes in the structure of relationships among the European powers, Russia's position actually improves. Russia becomes stronger. Strong enough to pursue a forward policy in the Balkans. Right? And in fact, that's the meaning of what happens in 1912. That's the meaning of the Balkan League. You recall, even the French leader, Poincaré, when he was shown the text of the Balkan League treaties, said in 1912, this carries within itself the seeds of a war, not just against Turkey, but against Austria as well. Unilateral changes in the Balkans. Changes that look forward to the vast expansion of Serbian territory, Serbian power, without first getting the okay of Austria. And given that Germany, the most powerful country in Europe, was Austria's ally, the Russians were playing with fire. Again, incidentally, this is another reason for putting aside these kind of notions of One state is the guilty party. It's not as though the Entente was pursuing purely defensive strategies. You look at French policy in Morocco. This is not a purely defensive, status quo-oriented policy. You look at the policy of the Entente in general. You know, excluding Germany from any important increase in her colonial holdings. So. All right.
Okay.
And that's the context for what happens in 1914. The sense on the part of Austria, increasing desperation that this whole problem of Serbia has to be dealt with, can't be dealt with in a relatively collegial way in conjunction with the other European powers, because the Entente has shown this willingness to simply ignore Austria's vital interests. Why was this? It was because Britain and France had become increasingly dependent on Russia, so that the notion took hold in those countries that Russia had to be supported no matter what, no matter what the rights and the wrongs of the situation were. you had this this sense developing in Germany that a war, a showdown between the two blocks was inevitable. After all, in a mere decade, you know, from 1905 to 1914, you had, you know, crisis after crisis. You know, first Moroccan crisis, Bosnian crisis, second Moroccan crisis, the crises of the Balkan Wars, and finally the crisis of July 1914. When you have that situation, people come to think a war is inevitable. We saw how the Russians were in effect telling the Serbs, pointing the finger at Austria, saying the Austrian ulcer is about ready to be carved up. Right? In that situation, if you think the war is inevitable, a whole other set of considerations comes into play. Namely, if war is inevitable, shouldn't we have it at the time that's best for us? If we can't count on our allies to support us over an issue where their interests aren't directly at stake, maybe we should make sure the war breaks out over some issue where we can make sure that our allies will support us. And this is a calculation that was made on both sides. Britain and France think, if war with Germany is inevitable, let's make sure that it breaks out over some issue where Russia is involved. And Germany says, if war with the West is inevitable, let's make sure that it breaks out over some issue where Austria will suffer. So you have, all these concerns about what the military balance are, and how that's shifting, and how the Germans had come to the conclusion that the whole Schlieffen Plan, their only hope for avoiding a war of attrition, their only hope for, reaching a decision in a relatively short period of time, how the viability of the Schlieffen Plan was becoming increasingly problematic as Russia, with French financial aid, increased her ability to mobilize quickly. Because the whole essence of the Schlieffen Plan was that Germany would be able to ignore her eastern border and concentrate her forces in the west. But if Russia can mobilize quickly by building all these strategic railroads and so on, then Germany would have to divide her forces. She couldn't amass a strong enough army in the West to knock France out quickly, and Germany would then have to fight a war of attrition. Right? They could see this coming. Therefore, the notion was, if war is inevitable, shouldn't we have it out now? And those considerations certainly did come into play. Incidentally, is that reason in itself to condemn the Germans? It all depends on your judgment of basic policy that those strategic considerations was designed to support. Okay, so you have a process with a certain logic to it, a logic having to do with power politics, not with right and wrong necessarily. As the relations between Germany and the West deteriorate, Russia's power position improves, right? That enables Russia to pursue a more forward policy and so on. That's a strict power political logic. What does this mean in terms of the questions that we're interested in? Once you identify the logic of that process, then the whole issue of what makes for war? What kind of policy should be pursued? Appears in a totally different light, because the goal, the whole issue of what makes for war, does not turn on a judgment of political behavior in a great crisis like July 1914. It's to be understood in terms of this broader historical process. That's number one. Number two is that these issues of what policy should be framed not just in terms of what can you do to deter an aggressor at a time of crisis, but rather what sort of political choices can you make over the course of years, decades, that could affect the way that crisis runs its course, so that at any particular point you look at the political choices that are made in that context. And you try and figure out what to make of them. You try and draw certain conclusions that relate to this general issue of what policy should be. Are there guidelines for the conduct of policy? Okay. So even though to get at these problems, your first goal is to kind of put these issues of judgment to the side and simply try and understand how a political process runs its course without being judgmental. Still, that's simply setting the framework for thinking about these issues. Right? Once you understand the logic of the process, then at particular points, you could think about policy. What should it have been? Could it have been different? If we could say should have been different here, should have been different there, what sorts of general conclusions emerge from that? Okay. So you're ultimately going to make judgments. But then the question is, when you're making these judgments, when you're trying to draw conclusions from your study of policy, what sort of yardstick should you apply? A yardstick based on your own personal, moral, ethical standards? Does this policy make for war, or is it a very different sort of yardstick, a political yardstick? Does the policy make sense from the standpoint of the power political interests of the country involved? And it's kind of an amoral sort of thing. You're not making any judgment about the legitimacy of the fundamental goals of a country. You're trying to understand how the political choices that are made affect its position in the international political system. Okay? And so, one of our fundamental questions here in this course had to do with the sort of relation that exists between those two separate yardsticks, those two separate sets of standards. Right? And there's this whole body of thought that we saw in Waltz, in Mearsheimer, and many, many other international relations theorists that argued that those two things kind of pull in opposite directions. You know, if you apply moral standard, it's like your basic goal is how could you avoid war? What sort of policies are in keeping with your notions of justice? If you apply a political standard, it's what's in a country's geopolitical interest. And the argument is that if every country pursues policies based on their own power political interests, then you're going to have war. Then you're going to have this clash. That's what a war is about. A war is inherent in the basic structure of a system based on sovereign states. That's the essence of that whole argument. And yet, the fundamental issues that we're concerned with, which are these issues about how foreign policy should be conducted, those issues, to a large extent, turn on the whole question of whether there is that sort of conflict between the moral yardstick and the political yardstick. And so what I try to do is give you an alternate view to the view of people like Waltz. The alternate view is, no, there is no fundamental conflict here. If your goal is peace, you should want countries to pursue policies that are rational in power political terms. If everyone pursues policies that are rational in power political terms, that make sense in terms of a country's own power political interests, then that's not going to lead to clashes and conflict. It's going to lead to a stable international system. Why? Because policies that are rational in power political terms are policies that are in harmony, that correspond to the fundamental structure of power in the system. And if every state pursued policies that are in harmony with the fundamental structure of power in the system, they would also be in harmony with each other. You know? They would all realize what a war would entail. They would then reach these accommodations. You know, they would try and improve their power political position by getting as many friends and allies as possible, as few enemies as possible. If that logic applies all around, everyone would try and mend fences with as many other countries as possible. So on, if it applies all around, you'd have general peace. You know, those kinds of arguments, right? How do you get to the bottom of that issue? That's a fundamental issue we're concerned with. How does the international system work? It's a world of sovereign states, essentially a world where states are destined to clash with each other? Or is it the case that if countries behave rationally in that kind of world, then you'll have a relatively peaceful system? How do you get at that issue? Right? One and only one way. By kind of looking at the historical record through that lens, trying to see from the historical record whether policies that make sense in power political terms are a source of instability or a source of stability. You look at the particular problems in the system. Do they result from policies that are rational in power political terms or from policies that don't make power political sense? Okay? And here, over and over again in the course of the quarter, I reached the conclusion that the problem was that these policies didn't make sense in power. Okay, we can start with the most recent stuff and then go back. The First World War. Military stalemate on the ground. You'd expect if countries were rational and believed that policies should be in tune with power realities, that they would have reached for a compromise peace, a negotiated peace. But none of these countries do that, and without regard to their internal political system. The most liberal, the most reactionary, it's all the same story. Compromise peace is ruled out. You look at the United States in particular. Here it's Woodrow Wilson, great champion of the liberal approach to foreign policy. Soon as the United States comes in the war, all these notions of peace without victory, peace among equals, thrown out the window. Now it's, we got to crush these people. The war is a crusade. Right? That's not power political thinking. That's the point of that Kennan article. The problem was that they were not thinking in power political terms. They allowed other kinds of considerations to come into play. Right? Considerations that did not make sense in power political terms. Or you look at 1914, pre-1914. Germany, for example. Was this a country whose policies made sense in power political terms? Even if all you wanted to do was maintain the status quo, did it make sense to alienate the three next most important powers in Europe all at the same time? Powers that controlled these vast imperial realms all at the same time? And then given that Germany aspired to fundamental change in the status quo, that made it even more irrational. If Germany had behaved more rationally, a la Bismarck, would you have had a First World War? An important question for you to think about. Okay? Or Britain and France. Did it make sense for them to cultivate this antagonism with Germany, or should they have tried to accommodate Germany? Because look at the effect of the policy that they pursued. Oh yeah, once a country is defined as your adversary, you really like to stick it to them. But that doesn't make sense if you're acting rationally. Because the effect of the deterioration of relations between Germany and the West was to increase British and French dependence on Russia, and thus to empower Russia and to enable Russia to pursue an aggressive policy that could draw Britain and France into a war. Does that make sense? Okay. And you go back, Bismarck's decision to take Alsace-Lorraine, alienating France. Being forced to conduct foreign policy, in effect, with one hand tied behind his back. Does that make sense? Or the Crimean War. Does that make sense? The kinds of policies that we saw in place, and Rich was just terrific on this, of Napoleon III and of Palmerston. It's like, are these people thinking rationally? They destroy the system. Destroy the system that had been put in place at Vienna. A system that did rest on realist thinking, whose basic notion was the balance of power. Basic notion was to kind of draw as many states as possible into supporting the status quo and have them balancing each other off. European equilibrium. Right? Who are the heroes? Right? Now those I think are kind of important points. But those are my conclusions. Those are the conclusions I reached. There's absolutely no need for you to simply sit there and say, well, he's the professor, so I guess I better believe what he says. And, you know, that's the last thing I would want in a class like this, because the whole goal is to sensitize you to the fact that these are very important, very serious issues with all kinds of implications. Implications about, not just about how international politics works, but about how foreign policy should be conducted. Should we try for a realist foreign policy, or is a liberal approach, a Wilsonian type approach, a much better way of getting at things? Right? Right. So the goal here is, number one, to sensitize you to the fact that those are important issues, serious issues, but number two, that it's possible for you to get a handle on them. By learning a method which will enable you to reach conclusions that you yourself have some real confidence in, so that you're not simply dependent on what I say or on what Walt says or what Mearsheimer says, or you could figure out what the answers are yourself. All right, and so that's why I think kind of to my mind the most important part of the course was the methodological part of the course. How do you go about making your mind up for yourself? How do you go about kind of taking charge of the issue and reaching conclusions that you think are valid? And the answer there was that there's a certain way of approaching the historical material so that you can reach conclusions of your own. A way of reading texts carefully so that you're able to assess their arguments. And we did this a little bit in the first part of the course with the whole business with Craig and Flanza and Halperin. And we did it in a much more serious way in the second part of the course with all of these things about the origins of the First World War. The Fisher theory. And you have the two chapters in which Fisher, developed his argument. Right? And I showed you how you can go about analyzing that argument by reading it carefully in its own terms. You know, instead of reading things in this kind of passive way, reading it actively, trying to figure out, what his basic claim is and what the key arguments are that support that claim, and then looking at the evidence that support those key arguments. Right? It's a method that enables you to kind of take charge of the problem. And then we also looked at the other kind of very common line of argument about the origins, the immediate origins of the First World War, namely that it was an inadvertent war, that it was a product of the military system that was in place at the time. And again, I wanted to kind of show you how you can go about unpacking that argument, analyzing that argument, getting on top of that argument, and thus ultimately reaching conclusions of your own. Okay, so if you've gotten some sense for what these fundamental problems are, and some sense also for how to get a handle on them, then I personally would be very happy, very, very content with what you've gotten out of this course. See, that is, to see that these are serious issues, but issues that are, to a certain extent, resolvable. Issues that you can get some real insight into if you approach them the right way. Well, that, in the final analysis, is what I hope you'll be able to take away from this course. So good luck on the final, and I'll see you here on Friday.